Okay, so welcome to lecture four. So what I want to talk about first today is the fast Fourier transform. Why do I want to talk to you about the fast Fourier transform? Well, the fast Fourier transform is one of the most elegant, most powerful algorithms that people came up with in the 20th century. It's really clever. Why am I going to teach it to you? Well, partly because it's clever and I think it's important for you to understand a bit of what's going on. But I don't expect you to be able to code the fast Fourier transform. So I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. Why don't I expect you to code it? Well, a lot of really clever people have already gone out and written fast Fourier transform code, and there's a lot of it that's freely available. And it's probably better than the stuff that you would write. Not meaning to be rude, but there's a lot of really clever optimizations that have gone into the versions that are out there. So, you know, I don't really expect you to go and try and duplicate all of that effort. What I do expect you to get is the fundamental principle behind the fast Fourier transform. And the principle is typically called divide and conquer when we talk about algorithms. It's a principle that's used in a lot of different algorithms. And so I have a really simple example here to show you before we make any effort to look at the fast Fourier transform. It's a simple algorithm for multiplication attributed to Carrot-Suba. So the question we start with is, how would we multiply large integers, large numbers together? What do you think of as a large number? I'm not talking about things like a million or 2 million. I'm talking about numbers where you might have 100 digits in the number. Now, if you have a number that's that big, the computational effort of just multiplying those two numbers together would be quite large. 100 digits in each one. So you're talking about, even if you're just multiplying the digits, it's 100 times 100, 10,000 multiplies. It's a lot of work. So what do we do? Well, the divide and conquer idea is fundamentally expressed. You take your problem and you break it into sub-problems. And you solve the sub-problems and then you put everything back together. How are we going to do that here? Well, we can always take a number, our number x, and we can write it as two parts, where one is some number x1 times w to the n, the other part is x2. So the simple example of this might be with powers of 10. Say we have a number like 1011, I can write that as 10 times 10 squared, 10 is my w, n is equal to 2, so at 10 times 10 squared plus 11. So that's dividing this number up. Likewise, I divided 205 here into 2 by 10 to 10 squared plus 5. So that's breaking it up. Then the product I can simply write out like this. You should be able to write this down without too much thought. It's just product of two sums. Now, you notice that in this product I have four multipliers. This one, this one, this one, and this one. So naively you might say, well, I've actually made more work for myself. The important thing though is these numbers are much smaller, x1 and y1, x2 and y2, they're much smaller numbers than the numbers we started out with. They have a lot less digits. In this case, we've gone from a number with four digits to two numbers with two digits. So if I'm clever about the way I do each of these multipliers, I can save myself some work. This is just showing you that multiplication done for the two examples that I have here. Okay, so clever about doing this multiply, it's still, say, started with a 100 digit by 100 digit number. These are still 50 digit numbers, say. X1 and X2, Y1. They're still 50, they're still big. So what do I do? Instead of doing this multiply, I apply the same algorithm again. End up with 25 digit by 25 digit numbers, and then 12 digit, and then I apply the algorithm recursively until the numbers are small enough that multiplying them is trivial. So once I get down to numbers like 2 by 3 or 5 by 6, I can just look up the value of the multiplication in a table. I don't have to do any arithmetic. That's the key. Doing multipliers in a computer requires, you know, multiple trips through an arithmetic logic unit. It requires quite a lot of binary operations. Doing this requires a bunch of table lookups. Table lookups can be implemented so that they're very, very fast. So doing multiplication like this, where you break it up to these small subproblems, where the small subproblems are really easy, and then you recombine everything back together, that can be a really fast way of doing a solving a problem. How does it apply to the Fourier transform? Well, the discrete Fourier transform that we looked at before, remember, we can write it as a matrix multiplication, an n by n matrix multiplied by an n by 1 vector. That's going to take order n squared computations, n squared complex multiplication. Remember, complex multiplication takes a bit more work than a standard multiplication, because you have to multiply the complex bits and the real bits and so on. So this is n squared operations. Now if you have a vector of a length of a million, n squared becomes a very large number. So we don't want to do that. The fast Fourier transform is order n log n. So imagine you have a vector with length of a million. Typically you might think about it in base 2, so log base 2 of a million is roughly 20. So the number of operations we'd have to do there would be around 20 million. Instead of 10 to the 12. So still a lot of operations. The Fourier transform isn't necessarily going to be really easy. When they first developed it, they were doing it on sequences with, say, 64 terms, and it was taking seconds or minutes to do. They didn't have very good computers. We can do millions of operations, but even so, you might be challenging your computer if you ask it to do a fast Fourier transform on a vector of length a billion. Still, you have no hope at all ever of doing that with a order n squared algorithm, whereas order n log n is much, much better. Not quite as simple as Karatsuba. We have to understand a few things about the symmetries of the Fourier transform before we can do it. I should say, historically, it's quite interesting. Gauss is reputed to have used the fast Fourier transform in some of his calculations. But he's never attributed with the algorithm. The algorithm is usually attributed to Cooley and Tookey. They came up with what we call now the Radix 2 algorithm, which is the one I'm going to describe today. In the 60s, there's good evidence, though, that other people besides Gauss used the fast Fourier transform well before this. So why is it called the Cooley-Tookey algorithm? It's called the Cooley-Tookey algorithm because they were the first guys to publish it. This is one of these interesting things about academia. Precedence is generally given to the people who publish results. The earlier people, at least reputedly, who looked at this were working for people like, you know, military companies, and they kept it secret. And so no one knew about it, and so, you know, 60 years after the fact, when the secrecy no longer applies, they come out and say, oh, we invented that long before Cooley and Tookey. They don't get any credit for that. They may have been jolly clever, but the credit generally goes to people who publicly talk about their ideas. So let's talk about how Radix 2 works, and I want to get through some of the basic ideas. I'm going to go fairly quickly. Again, I don't expect you to be able to reproduce the fast Fourier transform code. What I expect you to get is this intuitive insight of how we do the decomposition. How do we do it? Well, the first thing to remember is that our discrete Fourier transform and its inverse can be written like this, where instead of putting this e to the minus 2 pi in here, what I've put is wn. And wn is just going to be e to the minus I 2 pi divided by n. And notice I take this to the power n times k. So this is my discrete Fourier transform, just rewritten. Just to make it a little easier for us to write. This is a purely notational convention, so that when I write out some of the sums later on, they don't take up half a page. But we also have to note some symmetries of these WNs to certain powers. First, notice that if I add n on 2 here, I get minus W to the power of k. Why is that? Well, think of these guys as points in the complex plane. They're points on the unit circle in the complex plane. This adding of n on 2, there's n points around the unit circle, So when I add n on 2, I'm doing a rotation by 180 degrees. When I rotate by 180 degrees, I get round to a number which is minus the number I started with. When I add n, that's a rotation by 360 degrees. Rotation by 360 degrees gets me back to the point I first started with. So your knowledge of the complex plane will come in handy in this course, I've got to say. Knowing that we have these points around a unit circle in the complex plane and we just do this rotation means that we can see these symmetries obviously. Okay, so I'm going to take my discrete Fourier transform up here, and what I'm going to do here is separate out the even terms here and the odd terms here. You see that I've got the terms with 2n in here, where n goes from 0 to n on 2 minus 1, and the odd terms here. That's easy enough to do. Notice that I'm only going to do this for my values of k less than n on 2. This is going to make my life a little bit simpler for what I'm going to explain. Now, first things first, I notice that I've got wn to the 2n on k here. Let's go back to our definition of wn. If I put 2n in here, it's the same as putting n and having n divided by 2 here. So I can replace this w to the 2nk big N with a wnk big N on 2. So this is just, these are the same guy. These things are equal to each other. Secondly, I notice I have a wn to the k factor here, which looks different from this. So I'm going to take a wn to the k, and I'm going to pull it out the front, and then I'm going to use the same change that I used here to turn this thing into wnk on n on 2. Okay, very simple rearrangements, mathematical rearrangements going on there, nothing particularly subtle. The clever thing is, you take this thing and you look at it, and you say, ah, that's a Fourier transform. That's a discrete Fourier transform. So I'm just going to call that f of k. Likewise, this thing is a discrete Fourier transform. I'm going to write it g of k. F of k is the Fourier transform of the even terms from my original signal. G of k is a Fourier transform of the odd terms from my original signal. So what I've done is I've taken my signal and I've broken it into the even terms and the odd terms. And now I end up with something that's a good deal simpler to calculate. Why is it simpler? Well, think about it. The Fourier transform up here, that takes order n squared computations. Order n squared. Here I have two Fourier transforms. So you think that's 2 times order n squared. That's not right though, because notice that each of these sequences is half as long. So each of these Fourier transforms takes order n squared on 4 computations. Order n squared on 4 times 2 gives me order n squared on 2. So this computation takes half as many calculations, half as many multiplies as my original Fourier transform did, just by rearranging it. This is really clever. All I did is I rearranged my sequence, and now suddenly I have to do half as many multiplies. Obviously there's this extra multiply here. I have an extra multiply of this thing by g. I'm going to just ignore that for the moment because it's one extra multiply when I was dealing with order n squared. Not a big deal for the moment. Okay, so this is really clever. But one of the problems here is that this only works for k less than n on 2. Otherwise, this simple sort of rearrangement doesn't work properly. On the other hand, when k is greater than n on 2, I can use the symmetric properties of this thing to notice that wn to the k plus n on 2 is minus wn on k. And so I end up with a formulation for the bits where k is greater than n on 2, which looks like this. It's just a plus here and a minus sign here. Again, these are the same, f and g are the same Fourier transforms. The Fourier transforms are the odd and the even terms. So easy. Okay, so doing this reduces my calculation by a factor of 2. how do I really do the fast Fourier transform? Well, each of these guys is a Fourier transform. So I can use the same idea on that vector, that Fourier transform. I can divide that into even and odd terms. That will mean that I end up with order m squared on 4. And in fact, I can keep recursing, I can keep doing that until I get vectors of length 2. Okay, a couple of things here. You notice that each time, each step here, I'm dividing the vector into two odd and even parts. I'm assuming the vector is even in length. If I want to recurse through this, I have to assume the vector has length 2 to the n. This is one of the reasons why quite often when people do examples, two examples which they show you in lectures like this about the fast Fourier transform, you notice that they have sequences, data sequences which have length 1024 or 64. Why is that? Well, it's a power of 2. It means the fast Fourier transform will be really fast. Okay, this is not a limitation these days. In fact, this is called the radix 2 algorithm because we divide by 2 at each stage. But if you have a sequence which has, say, a power of 3 in length, then there is the radix 3 algorithm which you can use to perform the fast Fourier transform, and so on. So there are fast algorithms for most sequence lengths these days. So this is one of the reasons why I don't expect you to go and code it. It's easy enough to code the radix 2 algorithm. It's hard to code a general algorithm which will work for any sequence length that you put into it. What else goes on here? Well, you notice that as we decompose and decompose and decompose, we're going to end up with a whole lot of these multipliers. And these multipliers actually end up being a not insignificant amount of the computation in the end. So you end up with an algorithm which doesn't converge to order n, it becomes order n log n. So people typically draw these things diagrammatically, something like this. You know, again, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. This is just a block diagram to try and give you an idea of what's going on here. We take some set of our, in this case, the even terms from our signal. We do a length 4 discrete Fourier transform. And then we take the output of that, and instead of trying to calculate this directly, we would break it into a series of length 2 Fourier transforms. And then from that, we'd get our sequence. Actually, I'm kind of mixing a few things together here. So these block diagrams are intended to show you this recursion, but it's being drawn like I'm doing a sequence through a series of blocks as well. I have a better one in a second, but let me describe a couple of things first. You'll often hear people talk about bit reversal when they're talking about radix 2. Sometimes when you draw these block diagrams, you put the vector in a funny order, given like this, 0, 4, 2, 1, and so on. You get that by taking the bits and reversing them. So these are the binary bits representing the numbers 0 to 7, and these are the bits reversed, and you can see 1, 0, 0 represents 4. Again, I'm not going to spend much time on this, but I just thought it's worth you knowing what bit reversal means. The other thing I want to mention is, remember we can write our matrix, our big matrix here. Our Fourier transform is a matrix multiplied by this matrix A. Remember, these W's are just e to the minus I pi on n. Now, the radix 2 algorithm actually corresponds to a way of factorizing this matrix. And we can see that factorization here. Why is this factorization important? Well, the important thing about it is each of these matrices now is sparse. And I can do sparse matrix multiplication much more quickly than I can do matrix multiplication when I have a full matrix, when every term has some value. And in fact, I can write this sparse multiplication, instead of writing it as matrix multipliers, I can write it as circuits. And this gives you an idea of what that circuit looks like. So I can actually take this Fourier transform and I can hard code it into a circuit which does these various operations as I go through. We'll talk a bit more about these sort of diagrams later on, but basically the plus is indicating I take two values and I add them together. The dashed lines indicate that there's a multiplier, so the value I get out of here, I multiply by w to the power of 4 before I add it to this value. And the order of these guys, you notice there's this rearrangement of the order. This is the first signal, putting it in here. This is the second one, I'm putting it in here. The fourth one goes here. This is where my bit reversal comes in. So as I said, there's a variety of other algorithms. We call this divide and conquer. Sometimes people call it decimation. Decimation comes from a word that the Roman army used to use when they had a troop of, or a century of legionaries who were cowardly or disobeyed orders or something like that. They decimate that troop. The idea of decimation, I've variously actually heard this as what you would do is you go along and you'd kill every 10th soldier. The other way around, people say you kill 9 out of every 10. I don't know what the actual truth is historically, but the idea is that you do something to every 10th guy. You either let him live or you kill him. Here we're not doing it to every 10th, we're doing it to every second term. So it's not decimation, it's binarization or something that we're doing here. But you could do radix 10 where you did some sort of decimation sort of thing as well. How do we do the Fourier transform? As I said, many people have coded good versions of it. The one that we will mostly use, or that I mostly use these days, is MATLAB's version of it. MATLAB has a function which you'll be surprised to learn is called FFT, and it has a similar function called IFFT for doing inverse Fourier transforms. And this does a Fourier transform. The one thing to note is that MATLAB indices go from 1 to n. They don't start at 0. So even though I might write a Fourier transform mathematically, mathematicians will often write a Fourier transform like this, going from n equals 0 to n minus 1, assuming the indices here go from 0 to n minus 1. C programmers will do the same thing. MATLAB programmers have to change their brain a little bit so that their indices go from 1 to n, and you notice the summation here goes from 1 to n. And the indices here, we have a k minus 1 and an n minus 1, because we're starting at 1 instead of starting at 0. So that's the only thing you have to be careful about with the MATLAB fast Fourier transform. This is an example. This code is on my web pages, and you should also have it in your notes. On your notes page, you'll see that below this picture, there is a copy of this little MATLAB script. And in general, that's what I've tried to do. In general, what I've tried to do is on your notes page provide you with a little copy of one of the MATLAB scripts I've used, wherever I think it might be helpful to you. The other thing that I've done is wherever I have one of these little scripts or I've shown it, there should be a link on the web page. There is a list on your web page or on your CD for that matter, giving you the all the MATLAB code and the resources link. And so you can go there and you can download the various MATLAB scripts that I've used. Not that I expect that you need them particularly, but just to give you an example, tangible example here. The other reason for doing it, I guess, is you remember that I said you guys are going to do a project. One of the things I'm going to do in a break is give you a little piece of paper to write down your project groupings on. You should start to think this week about what that project is going to be. And next week I will ask you for a project title so I can get some idea of whether the projects you're talking about are going to be right for what we want to do. MATLAB scripts might give you a little leg up on that. There's one more trick to deal with when you're dealing with MATLAB scripts. Firstly, remember that when we take our discrete Fourier transform of a finite sequence, what we get is not the spectrum. So this might be the spectrum of our original series. But because of aliasing, what we actually get is a series of periodic repeats of that spectrum. And the distance between repeats is the sampling frequency, FS. Now, what happens when I do the fast Fourier transform with MATLAB? What happens is I get this green segment, this part of this spectrum. So when you do the fast Fourier transform with MATLAB of a real signal, what you will see if you look at the power spectrum, if you look at the Fourier transform, you see complex numbers, obviously. If you look at the power spectrum, we see real numbers, and we will see something that looks symmetric like this. this part here will be a repeat of this part, except for the DC term. The DC term won't be repeated over here. Quite often though, when we want to draw the spectrum or illustrate it for someone, we want to show something like this. We want to show this purple part of the frequency spectrum. We want to show the even power spectrum. Sometimes you only care about showing half of this. So you can always just plot only those values. But sometimes you want to draw it like this. MATLAB has a built-in function called FFT shift. So if you take, here I have this little code segment here, what I've done is I've taken FFT shift of the FFT of Y, and I've taken the absolute value squared to plot the power, and you can see that I get something which is symmetric. It's even, an even function. On the other hand, if I don't use FFT shift, I will get something that looks like this, where you can see frequency starts at 0, goes up to 1,000, and it's symmetric about this middle point, but this is the zero frequency, the DC term in the signal. So you must be aware of this when you're plotting Fourier transforms. I find it preferable to look at Fourier transforms or power spectrum that looks like this. It's not actually important. Either way is acceptable, but you have to know what you're doing. You have to know which one you're plotting. It's not okay to plot something like this and say, oh look, there's a peak at 800. There's a peak at 100, 200, 800 and 900. Okay, so there's four signals there, one at 100, 200, 800 and 900. That's not right. There's one at 200 and one at 100, and the other part is just a symmetric repeat of that. In fact, we could work out if it was a sine wave or a cosine wave, but we know that there's going to be one frequency involved there. So I have a little video I put up here. All it is is a picture I took in Hong Kong this year, and I just set up a little video of panning across that image. And there's a few things that I think are kind of interesting in this. The one that I want to sort of talk about is this kind of speckling that's happening here. So I put this up to spark your curiosity, hopefully. What I want to ask is, can anyone tell me why they think the speckling is happening? It's sort of, but this is quantized to a reasonable sort of level. That's part of it. There's definitely some compression artifacts going on here when you take the MPEG and you compress it. And if you pause at a particular frame, control here, you can see some of those artifacts particularly well. There's a certain blurring and can't see any blocking artifacts from here. Sometimes you see sort of little blocked edges where there shouldn't be. So there are compression artifacts going on in here. But there's some other things going on as well. So what I want to explain, or what I want to get to, is some of what's going on in that picture. To do that, we're going to have to start talking about transforms in two dimensions. So what are we going to do in two dimensions? Well, there's one basic thing that we want to have in two dimensions. We're going to have a basis again. We're going to have a set of basis functions. Remember, the Fourier transform, our basis functions are just the complex sinusoids, or we think of it as the sines and the cosine functions. So here we want to have a basis again, and it's going to be a two-dimensional basis this time, a set of functions we can use to represent our signals. So you can think of all sorts of clever things to do in two dimensions. But the thing that I want to get from my first basis I'm going to show you, the simplest basis, is what we call a separable basis. The idea of a separable basis is if I have a function like this, f of x, y, which I can write as a product of a function of x and a function of y. That is, I can separate out the x and the y dependence in that function. Then I want the Fourier transform to have the same property. Okay, so how am I going to do this? Well, as it turns out, it's really easy. The basis that I choose looks like this. And you'll notice that these functions are just e to the minus I 2 pi. This is the same thing we've always had in this function. It's got an s times x plus a t times y. This is just an exponential times with an sx in it times an exponential with a 2y in it. This is just the product of the two bases, the product of a basis of sinusoids which are running up and down through our two-dimensional picture and right to left. Okay. So why might we have a two-dimensional signal? Well, the classic two-dimensional signal is an image. I have a picture of an image here. This is an image. This is where we want to apply these. Images are discrete signals. Same issues that we have with discrete signals in one dimension. You have the sampling of that image. So we have the same sort of potential issues with things like aliasing. You have quantization. Quantization in images is very important because typically images have fairly small numbers of quantization bits. Quite often, say, 8 bits. 8 bits is very typical for a lot of images. Most GIFs are 8-bit images. JPEGs typically use 8 bits, but they would have 3 signals, one for the red, green, and blue. So that's actually 24 bits altogether, but you're representing 3 colors, which get mixed together in our head to give us our color perception. So really, again, in terms of quantization levels, you have 8 bits. So the quantization noise here is going to be significant. Once we have our image, we have a two-dimensional sample thing. Obviously, we need a discrete equivalent of the Fourier transform. This is it. Here, this is MATLAB's discrete Fourier transform. Then go, oh, this is not MATLAB, sorry. This is starting from 0 and going up to n1 minus 1. Remember, we would go from 1 to n if we were doing MATLAB. This assumes that we have an image which is n1 by n2 pixels. Pixels are the finite the elements in an image. Pixels are the little building blocks of that image, the individual squares that make up the image, the sample points, the sample values of that image. And when we display an image, typically what we do with a pixel is we show it as a square. That's not what I did with a signal before. Remember, I just took my sample point and I drew a straight line and showed you the point. What's happening here is when I'm displaying it, I'm displaying the value of that signal over that whole square. Why would I do that? Well, I want you to be able to see it. I want you to be able to perceive it. So what I'm hoping is that in your brain, you will take that square and you will interpret it as a color, and you will then put those together and get an image. Effectively, what I'm using your brain as is a digital to analog converter. I'm taking a digital signal. I'm doing a very crude digital to analog conversion. I'm just showing you that square pixel value, and then I'm letting your brain do the digital to analog conversion in your head. So let's go back here. To compute this efficiently, we do the 1D Fourier transform along the rows, and then we do the 1D Fourier transform along the columns. To see that, ignore this bit, and ignore this bit for a minute, and just look at this bit. That's just the Fourier transform along the columns, or say the rows. And then this bit on the outside would just be a Fourier transform along the rows. Sorry, the columns. So we do this as two one-dimensional Fourier transforms. This is, again, this is one of the nice things about the separable basis. The separable basis that we can write as a product, I can do this inner sum, and then I can do the outer sum. Obviously, I don't have to do it rows first and columns, and then columns. I could do columns and then rows. Typically, we might call this the row-column algorithm. Another nice thing about this way of doing the Fourier transform is it easily generalizes to many dimensions. We can do 10-dimensional signals this way. It's obvious how to extend this to a 10-dimensional signal. The other nice thing about this, imagine your image has n pixels in it. N1 times N2 would give you N. Imagine you have N pixels in the image, then this algorithm is order M log N. This fast Fourier transform algorithm is still order the number of pixels times log of the number of pixels. So it's still an efficient algorithm, at least as good as the 1D Fourier transform. So this is a little example. The left-hand side is showing you a signal, which is just my image. You notice one of the things MATLAB does is that when it displays an image, it starts with the first row up the top and then goes down. This is my first column and so on across. Now my signal is just a sign. You notice that I put K in here, where XNK is my image. Okay, so you think about this. K is my value across here. So this is going to change as I change K, and I get something that's going to look like a sine wave. The white values or the light values indicate large numbers. The dark values here indicate low numbers, negative numbers, for instance. So this is just showing me, if I took a cross-section across here, across one of these rows, it would be a sine. It would be this sine function. If I look up one of the columns, it's constant. And that's because there's no dependence on n in here, in this function here. There's no dependence on n, so if I look up one of the columns, it's a constant. So let's think about what the Fourier transforms of these things would look like. The Fourier transform of a constant is just going to have a value in the DC term. It's going to be zero frequency. A Fourier transform of a sine is just going to have two spikes, one on either side of the zero, the DC term, and remember one of them is going to be I and the other one is going to be minus I. But when I look at the power spectrum, which is what I'm typically going to show you here because it's quite hard to show you an image which shows you complex numbers, when I look at the power spectrum here, I'm going to get two spikes. Why do I get two spikes that are symmetric like this? Well, remember, the default way MATLAB works is it shows you, let's go back to this picture, it's the easiest way to do it. The default thing MATLAB shows us is this picture. So remember, it would be symmetric down the middle of the line. The DC term will be right up on this edge. So when we look at our image, when we interpret this picture, you notice that these values are right up at this top edge. That's the DC term in the vertical direction. What do we see here? In the vertical direction, we have a constant. So not surprisingly, these peaks lie in the DC term here. What do we see? They're symmetric around the middle of this thing. There's a spike here and a spike here. They correspond to one term of frequency up here, 3. Notice if you actually counted the pixels here, I haven't tried to draw individual pixels to show you, but if you counted them, this would be the DC term, so that's 0 frequency, 1, 2, 3. So that spike indicates a frequency of 3 in the horizontal direction. Similarly, here I have a signal which is got a sine wave in the vertical direction, and you notice the Fourier transform looks exactly like what you'd expect, but in the vertical direction. Now remember, the Fourier transform is a linear operator, so if I take the sum of two signals, this is just showing you the sum of those signals, you get a kind of quilted pattern, it's quite an interesting sort of pattern you get out of that. You take the sum of two signals, then the Fourier transform will be the sum of the Fourier transforms of these two signals. So I'm just going to get a couple of spikes up here which correspond to this part, and a couple of spikes along here which correspond to this part. Again, once I know what to expect, I should be able to draw one of these pictures pretty easily. Come along. Okay. What happens if I start taking slightly more complicated function? So here I have something where I have a sine wave, a simple sine wave again, but I have n and k both inside this argument. Okay, so now I've got a sine wave of sort of diagonally across here. I get two spikes again. We shouldn't be too surprised by that. I have one sine wave. So that's going to give me one frequency term, you might think. And it does. One frequency term and its reflection over here. But how would I work out where those pictures, those spikes would actually be? Well, to understand that, we have to start thinking about symmetries of the discrete Fourier transform in two dimensions. Now, remember, we looked at a whole bunch of properties of the Fourier transform in one dimension. And amongst those properties were some properties about symmetries. Here what I want to look at is the properties of the 2D Fourier transform. Now, firstly, the 2D Fourier transform has all the same properties that we had in the 1D transform, obviously generalized to two dimensions. So they're a little bit different in some cases, but generalized to two dimensions. But it has some additional properties. For instance, if I take my Fourier transform and I'm going to reflect it through the origin, so this is reflecting it through the origin, I'm going to get the Fourier transform with my signal reflected through the origin. So that's what's happening here. I have, maybe it's easier to explain this in a second. So this is one of the symmetries. This is one that we would probably expect. This is just a symmetry through the origin. It's the equivalent of saying that the spectrum or the Fourier transform of an even function will give me an even Fourier transform. MATLAB, still remember we have our FFT shift function. So whenever we use the FFT shift, remember this picture is not showing me the symmetry properly because this is really being symmetric around some sort of point here. If I want to really see the symmetries properly, I have to use FFT shift and I'll get two spikes close to the origin. Remember, this is telling me something about the frequency. The distance of this spike from the origin would be telling me something about the frequency here. We can do something more than this though. So what I'm doing here is I'm going to take the Fourier transform of a cosine function, so a sinusoid, but what I'm going to do is put a general function in here of x and y. The thing to notice about this general function, cos theta times x plus sine theta times y, is it's a rotation. So what I'm doing is I'm taking my xy plane and I'm rotating it and then I'm applying a cosine function to it. So that's what I did here effectively. I took a sine function of a rotated reference frame. So the piece of music that's on, I have for a reason. There's a nice story that goes along with this piece of music. It was written in the 17th century by Gregorio Allegri, and the Pope at the time declared that the piece of music could only be played in the Sistine Chapel over the week of Easter. So if you wanted to hear this piece of music, you had to visit the Sistine Chapel during that time period. There was no other way of hearing this piece of music until the 17th century, when a very young boy, 14, listened to the piece of music, left the Sistine Chapel, went home, and wrote down the music for this song. You'd be amazed, I'm sure, to learn that the boy in question was Mozart, and clearly he was quite gifted in terms of being able to remember pieces of music. The reason I have it playing now is because this is, I guess, one of the first cases of copyright violation in some sense, of violating the intent of the church to keep this piece of music secret. After the music spread, anyone could go and play this piece of music. I mean, you had to be a talented musician, but you could put together some people and you could listen to this piece of music. So suddenly it was out of control of the church. Now we have a lot of very close sort of analogies going on today. I can probably turn this off now, I guess. We have a lot of analogies going on today. One of the things that digital media allows people to do is make copies very easily, and the internet has facilitated this. The internet has made it much easier to make digital copies. Digital copies don't lose any information. A good digital copy is as good as the original digital image or digital piece of audio. So this creates a problem for people who want to protect their intellectual property rights by saying, you know, you can only listen to this music when I say you want to listen to it. So one of the ways people have gone about trying to prevent this is to put what we call a digital watermark into their content, into the image or into a piece of audio. And the reason for this is it allows you to trace back to, say, some copyright violator and then prosecute them for having stolen your intellectual property. And these watermarks have to have a few properties, obviously. Firstly, you want to make the watermark hard to take out of the image. And one of the standard ways of doing this is by making it hard to find in the first place. It's hard to take something out if you don't know it's there in the first place. Obviously, the watermark has to be recoverable, given that you know the key to that watermark. So given these two sort of properties, or normally three properties here, you have something that can be very helpful in digital rights management. So there have been a lot of research papers on how to build these sort of algorithms. And one of the standard techniques is to do it in the transform domain. So similar to the JPEG encoding, we talked about this a little last week, similar to JPEG encoding, you transform the image and then you do something to the transform coefficients. And the idea being that changing those coefficients is not going to be very visible in the real image. Of course, there are many, many problems with this type of watermarking. In fact, it turns out to be pretty easy to get rid of most watermarks just by doing some simple transforms of the image. For instance, recompressing the image is going to mess up a lot of these things that you've tried to embed in it. You take your image and recompress it using JPEG with a different quality factor, and then you do it again with a slightly different quality factor, and it's going to tend to change the quantization just a little bit, enough to mark up any watermark that you've embedded in it. Another way that people do this is by rotating the image by a tiny amount and then back. When you rotate an image, you have to do some sort of interpolation, because the sampling grid is rectangular, and you rotate it by a little bit, it becomes slightly offset. When you do that interpolation, you change some of the coefficients by a little bit, and this can also mess up the watermarks in the image. So it's actually very challenging to work out ways of putting watermarks that are hard to remove into, for instance, an image or an audio track. Another thing, though, that is, so this is about doing it in the frequency domain. Another thing that's a little bit easier to do is the idea of tamper-proof watermarks. So what's the application of this? Well, imagine that you are a police department, and part of the evidence that you might collect these days might be digital images. One of the problems with digital images, though, is it's relatively easy to go and change those images. It's very easy to just crop the image. For instance, say there's something in part of that image that doesn't add to your case, your prosecutor's case. You just crop the image and get rid of that bit. So you can show the incriminating bit, and the bit you didn't want to show is gone. Or you might take something like Photoshop and add something into that image that wasn't there in the first place. You might, you know, take your digital image and go away and put a picture of the person you think is the criminal. Put it into the image. So these things, I would, you know, hope that that sort of thing would never happen. But one of the things that's important in stopping it from ever happening is to provide ways of stopping these things from being tampered with. How could you do that? Well, it's relatively easy, compared with the other application I was talking about, to put a watermark into your image such that if that image is changed in any way, the watermark will be damaged. So, classic example of this might be you transform the image, you put your watermark into the coefficients in that transform domain, you transform back, you get your image, it has the watermark embedded in it. If someone does anything like crop the image, then when you transform it, the watermark would be changed. Likewise, if someone does something like add something to the image or edit something out of the image, the watermark will be changed. And so you get this way of tracing evidence from its collection through to when you show up in the court. So there are various applications like that that are a lot more practical in the sort of area of digital watermarks. Now, this course so far has really focused on Fourier transforms, and I want to give you a little bit of a view outside of Fourier transforms as well. So another application that I want to talk about today is tomography. Where does tomography come from? Well, there are a bunch of problems where it's quite hard to observe the actual thing that you're interested in. But you can get indirect measurements of it. So the classic example of this might be studying an ore body. You know, you have some ore body that's underground. You want to try and work out, is it a big ore body? Will I make myself rich if I go mining there, or will I bankrupt myself? So you want to work out how big, how dense, for instance, your ore body might be. Well, one way of finding it out would be to dig the thing up. But by the time you've dug it up, it's a bit late to really be working out whether or not it was big or not, because you've already spent the money. Another way that people do this is what they call borehole tomography. What you do is you drill a bunch of holes, and you look down those holes and you can see whether you hit the ore body or not. That's not really very useful, because you'd have to drill millions of them to really find out the ore body. You might as well dig up the ore body again. So what you do is you put down seismographs down these holes, and you send seismic waves through the earth, and you record the reflections and the transmissions of these seismic waves, and you get an indirect picture of your ore body. So this gives you a relatively inexpensive way of trying to investigate whether or not it would be worth putting a mine there and digging the whole thing up. Another classic case of tomography is computer-aided tomography, or sometimes computer axial tomography, of the human body, medical imaging. So this is an image of some person's brain. Now, one of the things that you'll find with people is they don't generally want to let you cut their head open in order to get a picture like this. You want to know what's going on in their brain. You want to find out if they have a brain tumor or something like that. People don't like you cutting their head open for some completely unforeseeable reason, and so you have to do some sort of indirect measurement. There are a whole bunch of ways of doing indirect measurements. For instance, you can do X-rays, or you can do what people call magnetic resonance imaging, or you can do positron emission tomography, where you look at different sorts of radiation and how they're either emitted by the brain or how they're affected when you transmit them through the brain. And I'm not going to talk at all about those particular sorts of technology. But the basic idea here is that you can make some indirect measurements. So there are a whole lot of applications. There's seismology, there's applications in oceanography, there's applications in archaeology, there's applications in manufacturing. For instance, if you have some process, say a big smelter, you might want to know what's going on inside the smelter, but it's very, very hot inside there, so if you put sensors inside the smelter, they get melted. So you make indirect measurements of what's going on in the smelter, and you try and infer what's going on there. Another application which I'm personally interested in is network tomography, where you can make indirect measurements of something like the internet, and you have to try and work out what's going on inside that big ugly network. So there are a whole lot of these sorts of problems. We typically call them inverse problems. We don't have to worry too much about that. We're going to look at a specific one of them related to medical imaging. Okay. So the word tomography, tomo, comes from cuts. It's as if you make cuts through something. Why would you say that? Well, imagine you have some object like this. Imagine maybe it's an ore body. The ore is much denser than the surrounding rock that it's embedded in. And you can make a series of measurements through that object. So think of these as cuts through the object. So these purple lines are trying to show you the rays going through it. Imagine that X-rays going through, say, some part of your body. Now, the trick with tomographic problems is typically you don't just want to make these measurements from one direction, you want to make them in several directions. So we're going to have an angle theta here, which tells me the angle at which I'm making them. And actually I'm going to measure that angle theta along this normal to the cuts I'm making through that object. And the other thing to imagine is that when we do this, we get some signal here. And if we don't go through the object at all, the signal is going to be low. If we go through, a large bit of the object, the signal will be quite large. If we go through a sort of intermediate bit, we'll get a medium sort of value. If we go through here, we get a low value again. So you can see as we pass our radiation, our x-rays, whatever they are, through the object, we get some signal which gives us a kind of profile of that object. It gives us a projection of the object in that one direction. And we can do that for a range of angles, theta. So this is showing you another angle. And you can see you get quite a different picture of the object when you look at it through a different angle. So the question you want to ask is, I can make these sort of measurements. Given I've made these measurements, would I be able to reconstruct the object itself? The answer is that you can do a pretty good job in a lot of cases. So let's think about this for a minute. What does this projection actually tell us? I'm going to call it P theta of T. Theta is just this angle. Remember, it's the angle of our particular projection. And T is the distance along this line. So imagine this was the origin. T would tell us how far we are away from the origin. So this is just a function. And we can work out what that function is by taking a transform like this. So f of xy is the value of the field that we're looking at. This is the x-axis, this is the y-axis. Imagine this thing is some function that we're interested in, and each of these rays, as it goes through, it integrates the value of that function along the ray. So if we have a lot of, you know, these, imagine these blue bits are large values and these white bits are low values, that corresponds to this function here. So let's try and work out the value at a particular point here. It's going to be the integral of our function f of x, y along this line. So that's what I've written down here. Why is this the integral along the line? This looks like an integral over space. Well, have a look at this delta function here. Let's just have a look at the next slide. This is the equation of a line. This is written in a parametric form where theta is an angle and rho is a distance from the origin. That's the same form I have here. Theta is an angle of this normal and t is the distance from the origin of that normal. So this delta function where I have t minus x cos theta minus y sine theta, this t minus, this is, if this is equal to zero, that's a straight line. So this delta function is a delta function along the ridge given by this straight line. So if I integrate over this function, f of x, y, with this delta function, what I'm really doing is integrating the function along this line. Let's just look at that for a second. Remember, this specifies a ridge which goes along this line. So this distance here is t, and this angle is theta. And we're going to integrate over space such that we integrate along this line. So this is a little trick we can do. It makes our calculations a lot easier as we go through here. This thing is just the radon transform. So I showed you the radon transform in lecture one, probably. And I gave you a little bit of insight about what the radon transform does, but let's go through that again. What does the radon transform do? Well, imagine my function here was a straight line, like this. What that would do is it would mean that whenever I had a straight line going like this, I integrate along this line, there's a tiny little bit that I get from here, tiny value from this. But it's a delta function, so it effectively is zero. Except when I integrate along this line. When I integrate along this line, the sifting property of this guy comes in and I get a value of one. So this line here, this is the space domain, this is the transform domain, this line here corresponds to this point. That's what the radon transform does. It transforms a line into a point. Think about it. This might be my ray through the object, and I'm going to integrate along that ray. If I integrate along some other ray, I'm going to get zero. So all of these other values out here are zero, except for this one where I integrated along this line. If I take a point in an image like this, then there could be a series of lines that go through it, and each line will correspond to a point in this plane. So you can see if I took a point in this plane, it gets transformed into a curve. So the radon transform has an interesting property. It's quite different in some ways from the Fourier transform. It takes a point in this plane, transforms it to a curve. It took a line, it transformed it into a point. What if I take several points? Each one of them will correspond with a curve in this transform domain. Several points. You notice that these curves are all overlapping here. They all intercept at this point. What does that point correspond to? Well, remember, a point in the transform domain corresponds to a line here. And not very surprisingly, this point corresponds to this line, which is just the transformed, this point transformed, excuse me, into the spatial domain. Okay, so this is what the radon transform does. And in fact, one of the most common uses for the radon transform is looking at images. So imagine this was an image, typical image, say a picture of a house, has a lot of straight lines in it. So one of the things you might want to do with that image, if you're doing image processing, is detect straight lines. So what do you do? Well, you look for you do something which is going to enhance the straight lines. I'll talk about those sort of filters probably in the next lecture. And then you do a radon transform, and the lines in this image will transform to points over here. So this is an example, an image with a couple of lines in it, and you see two bright points. So this is a way of detecting lines in an image, and it's quite frequently used in image processing tasks. We're going to apply it here in the context of our tomography, because this projection here is just a radon transform of our function f of xy. Okay. So now let's go back to the whole Fourier transform thing. What I want to do is take a Fourier transform of my projection at the particular angle theta. So this is just the definition of a one-dimensional Fourier transform for a particular angle theta. And all I've done here is substitute the p theta from the previous slide in here. Now, for well-behaved functions, f of x, I can change the order of integrals. So I put the dt in here first, and because this integral with respect to dt, with respect to t, doesn't involve x and y, I can pull f of xy outside of that integral. This is an integral with a delta function. So when I integrate with a delta function, remember I use the sifting property. The sifting property just says I'm going to have this thing effectively be zero. So t is going to be equal to x cos theta plus y sine theta. Put that in here, and I get x cos theta plus y sine theta. So that was simple. Just rearrangement of integrals. Likewise, next thing is pretty simple. All I have to do is recognize that this thing is also a Fourier transform. It's a Fourier transform where this part is s cos theta, the thing times x is s cos theta, and the thing times y is also s but times sine theta. So it's a Fourier transform of xy at these coordinates, s cos and s sine. Okay, so we could give a name to this function. I'm not going to give it a special name here, but I think there are people who give these sort of things special names, Fourier transforms that look like this. Just think of it as a Fourier transform at a particular set of coordinates in the SU space. We know how to invert a Fourier transform, don't we? I hope you know how to invert a Fourier transform at this point. It's pretty simple. It's just an integral. So now we know the Fourier transform of our projection. We know this guy. So we could make our projections. We get our p thetas. We do a Fourier transform of them. That tells us these Fourier transforms. Then we invert this, and we get the shape of our object back. So that's what this guy is actually doing, saying. This is an algorithm. What we do is we do the radon transform. This is effectively our measurement. We don't actually do a radon transform. We just perform our measurements, and that effectively gives us a radon transform of the object. Then we do a Fourier transform to get the slices, the Fourier transforms of the slices, and then we do an inverse Fourier transform. Now you notice that we have to do a whole bunch of these guys. To invert this, we have to know this Fourier transform over the whole plane. So to invert this, we need to know it over the whole plane. To do that, you see you can vary S and you can vary theta, but you have to take all of the possible values of S and theta. That will give you this guy. So that will work out. That's how we do our reconstruction. There are a couple of problems with this. Firstly, whenever you take measurements, they're always discrete. Remember, our measurements are discrete. So what does that mean? Well, it means that we make measurements at a discrete set of angles. We make measurements at a discrete set of values, at, you know, a finite series of these slices through an object. The number might be quite large, but there's this sort of sampling issue here. And this is important because we need to invert this guy, so we need to know its values at all of the points on the plane. But we don't know its values on all of the points of the plane because we have this discrete problem. But also, they're not even uniformly sampled over the plane. They're radially sampled. We get these values where S and theta are the things that are discrete. So we kind of sampled this plane at a series of concentric circles. And that has a impact on our inversion process. So let's see how we can actually deal with that. Let's take our function fy. This is the inverse Fourier transform. This is what we actually want to calculate. And you notice I've got u and v in here. Actually, I don't get to know u and v. I get to know theta and omega. So I'm going to write these guys like this. And I'm going to do a little change of coordinates here. I'm going to write this as a function of omega and theta. Do a change of coordinates here where I substitute these guys in instead of u and v. And I'm also going to do a change of my integral, what I'm integrating over. When I do that change, it does introduce this extra factor of omega. This comes from the Jacobian when I do this change of coordinates. So if you guys, you can go and check your second year differential equations course and you can check that I'm doing the right thing here. Now, this integral is still a bit of a pain to deal with. So what I'm going to do is split it. Instead of going from 0 to 2 pi, I'll do it from 0 to pi. And the second one, this is the integral from pi to 2 pi, but you notice that instead of doing it from pi to 2 pi, I'm doing it from 0 to pi, and I've put an extra pi in here, wherever I had theta. Now, simple symmetries of the two-dimensional Fourier transform, if I add pi, it's like taking minus omega. Remember, this is, let me draw you a little picture of what's going on here. So this might be my transform domain, and what I've done, you sampled that effectively on a series of concentric circles. God, haven't really done that very beautifully. But these would be my sample points. Because these distances are all the same. Remember, the S is the thing that's actually being sampled uniformly. So these intersection points are my sample points. And these are the angles theta. And this distance out here tells me S. Now, in this plane, imagine I go around here by pi. So that's pi. You can see that all I've done is reflect through the origin. So that's the same as instead of having, say, omega here, it's the same as having minus omega. So that's what's happened here. This and this. Now, when I substitute f minus omega in here, I don't want a minus here, so I'm going to then do a change of the sign of my integral variable omega, And then I end up with something that looks almost exactly like this, except I have a minus omega. So when I add them together, I get something that looks like this. And I end up with the absolute value of omega in here. And this integral now goes from minus infinity to infinity because of this minus omega. Notice here, it's from 0 to infinity. But now I have the integral from minus infinity to infinity and I'm right. Okay. So what's this thing here? Well, it's just the Fourier transform of our projection. It's this f theta omega. So I can take this integral here, and I'm just going to call it q theta t. And I see that my f of x, y is just the integral from 0 to pi of q theta at this coordinate. How does that help me? Well, look at what this is. This is almost like the inverse Fourier transform of f theta. But it's not quite. It has this extra factor of omega in there. What's that doing? Well, it's a filtering. What's it doing? Well, it's filtering out some... It's giving less weight to the guys with omega small. Omega small corresponds to the values that are in here, close to the origin. You notice that when we sample here, we sample more densely than we're sampling out here. So what this is trying to do is invert that effect. When we sample this way, we're sampling this part of the plane more densely. So we want to give it less weight, give these terms less weight. Whereas these terms out here, they're spread much further apart, and so we're giving them more weight in the inverse. So it doesn't actually compensate for the fact that some parts of the plane are not being sampled. And that can introduce artifacts into our result. Likewise, so actually there's a bunch of different ways of doing this filtering. This is one that we've derived from the sampling, but you can come up with a bunch of different ways of filtering this depending on the sort of thing that you believe you're going to be looking at and its frequency domain characteristics and therefore where you expect your sampling needs to be densest and so on. So what do you get as a result of this? Well, this is a little example. What I have is a block object here, and I've done 10 projections through that object at different angles. So this represents a particular slice through it, and this is the value of t. So if you look along, say, here, you should be able to guess that that's going vertically through the object because we're getting large values over a fairly small range of values of t. Whereas here, we're going horizontally through the object because we're getting moderate values because we're going through a smaller cross-section, but they're over a wider range of possible values of t. So we're seeing something that's long and thin, whereas here, we're seeing through the long, thin axis of the object. So what I've done is I've taken these. This is showing you the samples that I actually have in this. This is my theta direction, and this is t, and this is the inverted version of it. Now, you can see that that's not at all perfect. And again, this is a mathematical thing. In the continuous domain, if we perform those operations, we get a perfect reconstruction. But because of the sampling, we have finite sampling, we don't get a perfect reconstruction. But as we improve the sampling, you can see that we can get better and better images of the original. Okay, so that's 100 projections, and you'd say that that's not bad. You can do, in fact, better if you know something about what this object is going to look like. And you use that characteristic to inform your filtering algorithm. Here's a more complicated example for you to have a think about and get an idea of what's going on. Particularly, you get an idea of what this means when we're looking at the cuts through this object. So I have a little example here where these are my cuts through the object. You can see what the profile looks like. And if you look along this line, you can see that the values here give you a profile of that. The darker values are larger values here.